Hello, everyone, and welcome to LSE, and hello to everyone joining us online on the Zoom. It is my great pleasure to actually welcome you to the auditorium at the LSE. I almost have to pinch myself that this is actually happening, because this is our first event in person in over 2 years now. And I'm very much looking forward to our discussion. We won't forget our audience joining us online, so warm welcome to them. And hopefully they can join us for the next event. Tonight we'll be discussing profound changes caused by the pandemic, COVID-19 pandemic, in the Western Balkans. And I'm very pleased that it was Nevin Angelic's book, just hot off the press, titled COVID-19, State Power and Society in Europe, Focus on Western Balkans, that gave us the occasion and the reason to gather here tonight. I hope you'll have a chance to look at the book in greater detail, but the book does something that I've always thought someone should do, and that is to have a very, very careful look at all the indices and all different measurements of democracy and interpret what's happening in the region and more broadly in Europe, because your book has a much wider scope, through those indices. It's quite an undertaking. The book has quite a few interesting insights, all sort of generated from different perspectives, looking at the different measures, and that's something that we will be focusing on. And I think it will give us a very interesting perspective on what changed by the after the pandemic and how. So, as I said, it is Nevin's book, so it's my great pleasure to welcome here Nevin. So Nevin is assistant professor in international relations and human rights at Regent's University London. He's also visiting professor at the University of Bologna. And besides his academic activities, he remains as an activist for human rights issues in his country of origin, which is Bosnia and Herzegovina. He's also had a career in journalism, reporting for CNN, BBC, ITN, Channel 4 in the UK, and the local media in Bosnia. This is not his first book. Written one of the sort of key texts on the conflict in Bosnia previously, but his latest book on COVID-19, State Power and Society, is the topic of our conversation tonight. And I'm also delighted to be able to welcome Jasna Dragovic-Sosa. Jasna is Professor of International Politics and History at Goldsmiths, University of London. She's also a visiting professor here at LSE, which is LSE's unit on research on Southeastern Europe that is hosting this event tonight. Jasna has published numerous articles and book chapters on intellectuals' dissent, nationalism, state dissolution, and international intervention, and the process of memory construction and transitional justice in the sort of in the post-Yugoslav region in the Balkans. And she's also provided expertise on post-Yugoslav region to various non-academic stakeholders, including Foreign and Commonwealth Office and International Commission on the Balkans. And also joining us on the panel is James Gao. James is Professor of International Peace and Security and co-director of the War Crimes Research Group at King's College London. He has served as an expert advisor and an expert witness of the Office of the Prosecutor at the UN International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And it's actually there that he was the first ever witness at an international criminal tribunal And he was an expert advisor to the UK Secretary of State for Defense. The scope of James's interests and publications is so wide-ranging that it's almost daunting to comment on. But James written on issues ranging from conflict, security, transitional justice, including the role of arts in transitional justice. He is the author of numerous books. So I'll just mention sort of two recent ones. The co-edited volume, Reconciliation After War, Transitional Justice in Historical Perspective, which takes a historical perspective on transitional justice, so sort of another angle to his expertise on arts and conflict. And another one, which is also co-authored, The Art of Creating Power, Friedman on Strategy. So what we will do tonight, we'll ask Nevin to make a few introductory remarks on his book for about 20 minutes. I'll ask Yasna and James to respond, and then we'll open it up for discussion. We have a Twitter hashtag for this event. So if you're tweeting, you can use LSC COVID-19. This event is also being recorded on Zoom. So I'll just hand over to the speakers now. I have to use the mic, so I'll just pass the button to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This evening is very important for me. Arsenal plays at Spurs tonight, so this is the element to it. But actually, it is not unconnected to the topic, because in sport, it is possible to rank nations or clubs, against each other. And in politics, it's more descriptive, it's a problem. And I tried, somehow I always followed the indices of ranking various nations, but there was always a problem how to actually rank them all at the same time, because some nation is just exiting the elections or a certain phase and moving into the other, and so how they correspond to each other. Is it fair competition for this ranking? And then it came COVID. And basically, more or less, almost simultaneously, all nations of Europe went into the lockdown, and it provided the opportunity to actually this frozen situation of the states and society in Europe to observe them. And I decided to consult 20 indices that various institutions, academic and non-academic, are regularly on annual or biannual basis, observing and providing their details. So the methodology is a bit complicated, and it could be contested easily, because they use different methodologies, they conduct their surveys at different times. But the only possibility is also to address some of the, on occasions, surprising results that come out of some of the surveys. The example could be Economist Intelligence Unit putting, for example, Serbia as a flawed democracy like Italy, for example. And I mean, I think it's quite obvious that it would be very difficult to put them into the same category. But if you put together more indices, then it could kind of become almost irrelevant and provide the final result closer to the truth, closer to the fact. So my original plan was also suggested by the publisher to put COVID into the title. It was a kind of a good thing to do. But that was the easy element. But then some content had to be added. And what I was interested in searching the answer for was how these states, because after consulting all these indices, I categorize states with relation to the society from the open society, which I'm proud to actually address here at this institution because of the Karl Popper, but to the closed society and all the stages in between. So how these societies reacted, and there is no rule, basically, the least stringent reactions by the state are to be found in Belarus and Sweden, on the opposite ends of this ranking, and also looking at the peak of almost all societies with all states with their measures peaked sometimes towards the end of April 2020, and Georgia and Serbia had the highest index. I relied on several different organizations, but primarily for the stringency index on the Oxford University's Balloting School of Governance, and this is their results, but they were also changing methodology. So something completely new was taking place, and at some point one just has to decide, okay, this is it, this is the final result. I also tended to check on specific date later on how states adapted to the changed circumstances. So I picked up the last day of the 2020, 31st of December. And then there are some movements. One could find that some states lacked consistency in applying their measures. So, for example, Bosnia-Herzegovina, that was close to the top of stringency measures in April, was the least stringent on the 31st of December, together with Belarus. So it's a quite radical change, which perhaps resulted in a lack of the experience how to deal with public protests, because public disliked the stringency regardless of the health dangers that at the same time in a small society and closely knit society everybody knows somebody who unfortunately died from COVID, from the virus. The measures also were important by some other organizations like European Center for Not-for-Profit Law, that basically argued that civic space was endangered, and a few other organizations provided like a digital space, how it was endangered, how it was affected by the measures, and from the international organizations like the Council of Europe, derogation of powers with no strict time limit, that was something that actually affected not only less or not fully developed democracies, but also traditional democracies with open society, as I found later on. Then other institutes were looking at the democratic backsliding, at human rights violations like Human Rights Watch, and there is the list later on we will be seeing. The list of the countries actually all come from the area of the continent that is towards the east, its eastern end. And it is generally this geographic, more it is geographic spread, not only of democracy, but also of the state measures during the pandemic. But my general argument is that COVID did not cause changes in society. It only accelerated changes, something that was already present in these societies. And what was present basically increasingly authoritarian approaches in significant number of countries. What was also the case that globalization was suspended for a while. Previously, what was the case was that the state retreated, at least in economic fields, under the forces of globalization. And there was the reaction, because the perception was that the primary beneficiaries of the globalization were elites, this caused a reaction in increased popularity of the more populist, more nationalist political options that at least rhetorically managed to address a huge issue of inequality. And in democratic societies and democratic competition, then the number who would actually cast the vote for those who argued against those who were at the receiving end of the benefits was increasing significantly. Then the example I would offer the five-star movement in Italy, Beppo Grillo, who basically named the three destroyers and named them as journalists, industrialists, and politicians. So we have a kind of intellectual or cultural elite, we have an economic elite, and the third would be political elite. And the result was, although before the pandemic, that was the most popular political force in Italy at the last elections. Meanwhile, things have changed according to the surveys and moved to more towards the extreme ends on the far right. This is the issue that traditional forces from the around the center of the political spectrum in traditional democracies fail to address satisfactory, at least in the eyes of the electorate. Ray Dalio warned on the fact that disparity in wealth, especially when accompanied by disparity in values, leads to the increase in conflict. So this conflict in the society is something that I was trying to kind of observe the debate and to present to some extent, but the space was restricted. And this is where we come that populism might be, or populist forces might be established in power or in the influential position, but it doesn't mean that they would govern by democratic means. And this is where the problem of this conflict is exposed more frontally to the public. Danny Roderick, Roderick warned of the globalization paradox. So basically, the three features, democracy, sovereignty, and globalization. The problem is that only two could be held at the same time. And which one would be sacrificed? And the answer, obviously, with the increased sovereignty or preservation of the sovereignty, let's say in the Central and Eastern Europe, globalization is for the economic benefits and nobody could abandon it. So democracy is sacrificed. And this is really the problem. In the Western world, democracy is coming under threat. And we can see the example of Brexit is one of these examples that whilst the globalization is preserved, the sovereignty is returned back, taking back control, and democracy is under threat. It is still there because the institutions are fully developed and managed to resist these attempts. The centrist compromise has been endangered, and this is the feature that could be observed across the continent. The problem is that, for example, the study that covered 100 years in Europe in 31 countries between 1918 and 2017 found that this left of the center, usually social democratic parties that used to attract the following or the support of around 40% or in the 40s would be electorate support for them. Now, 100 years later, is usually in the 20s or even lower. I mean, recent example that is not in the book, but the socialist candidate at the French presidential elections was the 10th. She won around 2% only of the support. Then more extreme, more radical options on the left, the populist options of the 25 populist movements, most popular populist movements in Europe, there are only four are on the left wing or on the radical left. The five-star movement from Italy would be in the center. I would describe it, all the authors of this survey put it also among the leftists. And all the others, 20 other movements are coming from the right. So radical left is actually providing the support for the radical right. So this kind of linear understanding of the political spectrum definitely has changed, and we could look at the horseshoe presentation of the political spectrum, because they could easily move from one radical end to the other, and the examples could be found in the so-called red wall in the north of England that even these local elections didn't manage to undermine something that has been achieved at the last general elections in 2019. And so these tensions in the modern society, all the political forces are looking at how to solve them, and the state is looking how to solve them. Let me remind on the Dahrendorf's view that the state, in order to remain competitive globally in economic terms, has two options. One is to be detrimental to civil society, and the other one is to restrict civil liberties and political participation. And it does seem that this is exactly what is taking place right now. So we have a more controlled society now as a result of these kind of different forces and one political force taking the advantage of the current circumstances and possible resistance by parts of the society towards these forces and taking over the power in the state. So what we have is that a more controlled society is the result of this that is represented by a strong, usually nationalist leader, and who is in power, those who are perceived as anti-elite, not necessarily not being elite, but perceived as such. And the society is thus becoming a platform for identity politics. And this is how everything has shifted over the last decades. And it is underlined by the developments over during the pandemic over the last couple of years. So the perception is that those who are underprivileged, socially disadvantaged, have increased opportunities with these kind of changes that are occurring. But the time will tell whether this is the right or the wrong perception. And this is what brings us to the subtitle of my book, Focus on Western Balkans. Again, a suggestion by the publisher, you should focus on some micro area. And trying to avoid to be typecast as a kind of Hollywood beauty, not being in Hollywood. But I ended up anyway focusing on Western Balkans. And so what I did, observed what was taking place there. And in this survey that covered 45 European states, I actually was shocked. I never thought in these terms. 24 of these 45 states went through the kind of transition from communist regime towards some kind of democratic regimes. And half of these 24 are also post-conflict societies. Some of them, unfortunately, are not post-conflict, but are actually in the conflict. So this is adding complexity to the situation in these states and in these societies. And Western Balkan states, almost all of them could be easily described as both post-conflict and post-communist. And it led to the term that is, again, in this institution first developed, published on the LSE blog, stabilitocracy. This is actually what is taking place in most of the countries, most of the regimes in the Western Balkans. So what we have is for example, we should have had this in winter. It's a trees and description is a media of, for example, Serbian president, Europe's favorite autocrat. He's not the only one. We have quite a few that are being described from this region as such. Or misunderstood as liberal, for example, because of their fashion sense, like Albanian prime minister, because wandering around in tennis shoes and so on. But what is important, the index, that I divided into five categories, although it's debatable, these categories so, might be shifted around. But one category is freedom of expression and media. And we have five countries that are in the same category from the Western Balkans, together with the countries like Hungary, like Poland, like Croatia. So we can see this perhaps less well performing the members of the European Union are quite similar to those who are better performing from the Western Balkans, outsiders. Serbia is the inverse category of difficult with together with Ukraine. The next category of human rights, the rule of law and perceived corruption. Again, we have, sorry. Again, we have five in the same category. It's horrible. Yeah. If I die, pass over my last words. Okay. So I can't.
Should we have a bit of a break?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so do you want to speak?
Yeah, sure. I can take us.
Thank you.
And hopefully you can recover.
I think you're almost to the end of your notes.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Nevin, for inviting me to comment on your recently published book. And thank you, Denisa and colleagues at the LSE for having me here and for organizing the panel. I will begin by stating the obvious, I think, which is that, as far as I know, this is the first book that combines an analysis of the most important indices on political regimes, on the rule of law and human rights, and on political, economic, and media freedoms, and combining them all in one place, with a discussion of the impact of COVID-19, at least when it comes to the Western Balkans. I don't know if that's been done anywhere else, but I think this is quite an original book. And I think Nevin's overall argument, which he just mentioned, is quite apt, and indeed, I would say, pretty much indisputable. Namely, I'm quoting page one of your book, that the pandemic did not change politics and society. It rather accelerated and strengthened tendencies and trends that were already present and developing before the virus spread. So I think very briefly, what I'm going to try to do is just summarize what I understood to be those tendencies and trends, and then how COVID-19 accelerated them. And then in my final remarks, I will just finish off with a couple of questions to Nevin. This is his evening, and so hopefully he will have a chance to expand a bit more on some aspects of the book. I would say that Nevin's analysis broadly concurs with the studies that have been published in the last several years before the pandemic, which have shown that the Western Balkans as a region, despite some internal variations, have effectively been backsliding in terms of the key criteria relating to democratization, economic reform, the rule of law, and political and civic freedoms. And this, I think, is clearly borne out in the data that Nevin has compiled from some 20 indices and that he presents in detail and discusses in the book. I think while there's some variation depending on the index used, Nevin clearly shows that Western Balkan countries have tended to be clustered towards the bottom of these scales and in general have been defined as opening societies and at best, and mostly have been categorized as suppressed societies, with only Turkey, Russia, and some of the post-Soviet republics, including Ukraine, ranking lower than that. The recently published 2022 Freedom House ratings also corroborate this broadly negative picture that places all the Western Balkan states in the category, I'm quoting, of transitional or hybrid regimes, and showing either no improvement in some cases, even deterioration in their overall democracy score in the last year. So basically, these trends and tendencies continue. In general terms, the Western Balkan societies have shared the same characteristics in this period. And these have been broadly characterized as growing authoritarianism and personal rule, which thwart democratic processes and undermine the rule of law, and also undermine the independence of state institutions. The ruling political regimes have also heavily circumscribed civil society and media freedoms, whether by direct intimidation and harassment of activists, critical media, and journalists, or by controlling their sources of funding. Similar trends have been found in the economic sphere, where relations between key economic actors and political parties are so intertwined in the region as to be almost indistinguishable. There is a lack of transparency, and there are endemic problems of clientelism, nepotism, and corruption. Ethnic nationalism, as we have seen, was on the rise already for several years before the onset of the pandemic, as was manifested by some of these large public projects that glorify historical periods and public and figures, and also an escalating discourse of denial about the 1990s, or in some cases the 1940s, and the glorification of war criminals. Meanwhile, the region as a whole has also been experiencing an important net emigration, particularly of young people who believe that they have no future if they stay in their countries of origin. All of this is in Nevin's book. Now, the COVID pandemic seems not only to have continued these processes, but also accelerated them. And Nevin addresses this in the final chapter of his book. He notes that while civic freedoms were restricted across Europe during the pandemic, in the Western Balkans, the pandemic was used specifically to crack down on government critics in the media and in civil society by passing laws or taking actions to restrict freedom of expression and curtail media integrity. COVID-19 has also heightened the levels of implication of political authorities in corruption and criminal financial schemes, as for example, those involving the purchase of defective or inappropriate ventilators in both entities of Bosnia and Herzegovina. And this at a time when the authorities were failing to secure a timely purchase and rollout of vaccines through a combination of systemic failure and a failure of political will. The 2022 Freedom House report notes the shocking statistic that the COVID death toll in Bosnia and Herzegovina has, in some parts of the country, been several times higher than that of the Bosnian War, leading, as I'm sure many of you know, to spontaneous outbursts of public protest, which, however, did not translate into any significant political change. The same report also notes that by July 2021, at least 85,000 Bosnians had left the country permanently, which is almost double the previous annual average. These are pretty shocking statistics. Meanwhile, of course, we have seen another side of the COVID pandemic, which is what is referred to as vaccine diplomacy in neighboring Serbia, thanks in part to the Vučić government's links with China and Russia, and which has contributed to the domestic perception of the regime's success and helped it cement its two electoral victories in 2020 and last month. To sum up, I think Nevin's book presents an excellent snapshot of these various trends of the last 5 years as captured through a range of indices and analysis. And as any good book, it brings up a number of questions, which I hope Nevin will have a chance to explore in this discussion, hay fever permitting. So I will just finish off with these questions. And my first question is really, How do the tendencies and trends that you identify in the Western Balkans compare to other regions? And this you have already alluded to in your presentation today. Some of these are closer to home, such as, for example, the post-Yugoslav states of Croatia and Slovenia, or in the broader European neighborhood, such as, you know, again, you've mentioned Hungary and Poland, and some further afield, both in Europe and perhaps more globally, because we can see these trends even in the US and India or Brazil, for example. In other words, how are we to think of the Western Balkans in this broader framework? Would you see them as a precursor of some of these trends, as simply another example of them? For example, as a heightened manifestation of broader trends and a specific period in history? Or do they represent an aberration, a more virulent manifestation of something whose roots need to be sought in historical legacies specific to the region itself? Well, and the most often ones that are cited are, you know, examples of late modernization and state development, the socialist legacy, and in some cases, the unmastered past of the conflicts of the 1990s. You know, these are the usually mentioned causal factors. So I'd like you to think about, you know, this broader comparative perspective. And then zooming in a little bit, again, using your comparative framework, I think it might be worth exploring the differences in the trajectories of these Western Balkan countries with similar countries. And here, for example, the one that comes to mind and that intrigues me is Croatia, which also manifests some of these same trends and carries these same legacies. And yet it has tended to score higher in the indices that you mentioned and has been placed in a different category than the Western Balkans. For example, in the 2022 Freedom House report, it has been defined as a semi-consolidated democracy. So this is a different category. So in your view, would you say this is an accurate reflection of the difference between Croatia, for example, and the Western Balkans? And if so, what would you attribute this difference to, considering a similar historical trajectory? Does it come down to questions of political leadership, EU membership, or something else? And one could, of course, ask the same question about other countries too. But I think the Croatian case is particularly intriguing because it's such a close comparator. And I will end there. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. I face a great challenge of trying to hold the microphone, talk and think what to say, and focus my blurring old eyes on the notes here. I don't think this is going to go very well, but I shall try. Before anything else, I hope not to offend anybody. Well, I never hope to offend anybody, but it can happen. But just on what Jasna was saying at the end, I was curious about the separation of Croatia from the Western Balkans, because if Western Balkans makes any sense as a term, then Croatia is a part of it, not something outside it. But that's not for the discussion now, but it was just an observation that Freedom House or somebody seems to be making that curious distinction. I want to thank Denisa and Nevin for putting this together. I confess at first I thought it was a curious idea. I didn't think I was going to make it here as well. And now I am. I'm very happy that I did, especially because we got reference to Eddie Rama's fashion. And I have to tell everybody else here, there is a great photo that I have. Not a great photo, it could be a better photo, but it's been with Eddie Rama and Denisa in the garden at St. James's Palace. With those, the one thing that's really sticking out is those white sports shoes. That's the thing that really makes it. And also, it's great to be here with Nevin, who in the preface to the book reminds me that it was 20 years ago, probably a bit more than that now, that I was involved in examining his PhD. So that's kind of quite nice to have that continuity and still to be here that far on. I have six things, and I realize I've wasted most of my time already saying those things, but I'm trying to zip through in relation to all of this. The first is on the indices themselves, the idea of using the indices. which I creating league tables. I've always had problems with people trying to create league tables for things that are not football. And in this case, I think you may have found a way of making some sense of all of that. One of the problems with league tables for things that aren't football or similar is that they're quantitative. And I find great problems with most of the judgments that have to be made in any of this kind of world by turning to quantitative approaches. So you need that blend of qualitative and quantitative. And I think what's interesting is to take 20 different sets of indices and to find a way to blend them to produce a new analysis that can offer some insights that are of great interest. And some of those I will come to as I go on. But in the spirit of a book discussion, I'm going to ask the question, yeah, just how did you come to that? How did you actually practice it, if you can answer that quickly enough? Yeah. And what were the problems along the way in trying to compress those 20 different approaches and studies into one thing that made sense? Secondly, on CV19, it was interesting to hear that it was a marketing suggestion to include it in the title, but in fact, it would have been a cause for a really good question to be posed. And I think having been obliged to do it for marketing, actually, you've made something of it as a good research question. The idea that it's a catalyst is important, but I think also perhaps what you don't get, I would suggest discussion of this further, is as a marker, because you discuss the trends of globalization versus local retraction, of course. And what it is here we have is a real example of using all of this work together to look at a marker of globalization. CV19, in a sense, was the maximal example of globalization, of the way in which contemporary communications allow connections and transmissions, not just by electronic means, but by old-fashioned viral means, but in ways that are just the same as they were with the plague in the 17th century. Yeah. And if you read Daniel Defoe's Journal of a Plague Year, so much of what happened in the early stages of the COVID crisis is just the same kind of thing. You read the same thing, except it's not happening just in London. It's happening all around the world in one place. And so I think each a marker of globalization is its most extensive, and the responses are the kind of extreme opposite of that. And you're looking all the time, this contrast of the extremes, of the reaction of putting everybody into silence, closing borders, limiting movement. It's the exact antithesis of globalization. So what you've got here is a lot of material that's showing a real marker of the kind of things you're talking about and you were working on already as trends. You say that globalization suspended or ended it for a while, and that's probably true, but that process is going on, and I think that's interesting to follow. And I'm going to continue in that vein to my third point, which is the discussion you have about the cosmopolitan elite, which I'm not sure you mentioned in the introduction. If I did, I missed it. But that is also a really important element to keep in mind. You say that elites, and this is both a truism and a perception, elites benefit from globalization. That poses questions of equality, stroke inequality. Those are manifest in Brexit. And here I can do three things at once. The great actual quote in the book, "The cosmopolitan elite produced stupefying policies and could not address a popular desire for autarkic economic nationalism." You know, that is the summary of what we've been talking about, but the COVID crisis presents the extreme markers of that world. Yeah, and I speak as somebody who's part of that cosmopolitan elite, but I recognize that I am. And we're just a very thin stratum. And the issues with Brexit, with the things that have happened in the US over the past few years, not to speak of parts of Europe and the so-called Western Balkans, whichever countries are part of it, are all part of that trend and those divisions. And I think when you make the comments about Brexit, it's spot on. And what many of those of us in the cosmopolitan elite missed was precisely that there's a whole world and millions of people out there who are not part of that world and disenfranchised, and that needed in some ways to be acknowledged.
because social processes were afoot and everybody's in their own little world, not realizing quite what's going on and how it's affecting lots of other people. And in that context, you know, I remain a Remainer. Unlike most Brits, I was actually a positive lover of Europe and the EU, despite its bureaucratic awfulness. But I was positively opposed to it. And I know hardly anybody who was for Brexit. And just now in Belgrade last month, the same kind of discussions as Vucic was overwhelmingly elected, and friends and relatives saying, I don't know anybody who voted for Vucic. Where are these people? Who are these people? And it's the same kind of phenomenon. Those people who are part of an elite, not really getting what resonates with other people. The fourth point, and this is perhaps the least developed, but for me, maybe the most interesting aspect of things in the book, is about diplomacy. You write about the way in which Russia used, as it does anything else, the crisis to exercise influence, to make offers and do it. What would also be good for further discussion is the way in which Serbia, is in a mini sense, did the same thing. I don't know how Naba and the government worked with Israel to get in ahead of schedule on the, yeah, even ahead of the UK getting in on the Pfizer stuff with Israel, way ahead of things, and then using that to be a good neighbor, to give everybody in the region the chance to benefit. But of course, only if they did the right things to cooperate with the way it was being suggested and delivered. So yeah, gaining influence in that kind of a way. But it's an example again of the way all of these trends work. Now onto the heavier stuff. You talk about, and there's a great quote, which I'm not going to dig out because I can't dig out two quotes in one session, but about the process of establishing, quote, irrevocable liberties and rights and open societies. And this, those words give rise to questions. Okay? Process, it's something that's continuing. And that is absolutely right, because those things of which you write, liberties, rights, the open societies that they produce, are never established and never irrevocably established. They are work in progress. One of the beauties of the open society, of the open liberal system, and you cited Karl Popper at the beginning of the discussion, is that they provide, it's about recognizing fallibility, about recognizing imperfection, in saying we don't have all the answers, and yeah, just as a body needs to breathe in and breathe out, yeah, we have to recognize that the checks, the questions need to be addressed, and we need a framework for doing that. So we need awareness that that is being challenged, that that is underway. Yeah, it's fine for us in our little bubble that the LSE, in a cosmopolitan elite, to see these things going on, but it's how do we translate that? Because one of the things I skipped over in the bit before, I think, is to talk about the US. I know so many people, including people from clubs to national intelligence circles in the US, who are concerned about the prospect of civil war in the US, reflecting the way in which US societies, and there are many of them, plurals, are responding to the same kind of pressures and discussions. Yeah, so it's how do you get involved in that process, that continuing process, and keep it awake and keep it fresh. The US system resisted one wave of Trumpism as a manifestation of all of this. Yeah, it has to be ready to resist another and maybe more than that. But what is it? How do you do that? I don't know the answers. I don't know anybody does, and I don't know if anybody can, because they're going to be worked out, trial and error in practice, as people try to do that. But the first thing is to be really conscious and focused and trying to do what we can, where we can, to stand up for those open societies in which questions can be posed. And in that context, you say about the left and right getting closer together, or people swapping roles quite easily, because the left or right circles, like in a room like this, they come round to be near to each other. It's what happens, you say, to a left centre, but actually I think to the centre. Or, and on that, I'll just raise a question again about what happened in France just now. It's a really interesting trend that goes against everything else, because it was the centre against the radical right, not the radical left against the radical right. And maybe there's something to learn from France. I don't know what it is, again, how we go about learning it, but it's something to look at and investigate. It's a big question there. And finally, all of this, you lead to the sense that this is a phenomenon that could be called deliberalization, which is spot on. And it's about the fight to restore deliberalization, to recognize the danger that is afoot. And I think further steps in that are to see that there is a global process. It's a historic thing. It's always been there at one level or another, but in the age of a globalized world, it is a global phenomenon, a struggle between individualism and collectivism. Yeah? If we look at what's happened in the last 30 years with AQ, Al-Qaeda, with IS, the whole ideas of extreme radical Islamism, those are ideologies of the collective, opposing the societies, the states, the world, where individualism and fallibility and mechanisms of correction are present. And that's, I say, that's not new. It's historically ever present. It was the essence of the Cold War, the struggle between the West and the Soviet Union. It just continues in new ways, but with greater stakes, I would say, being relevant. It's about political, the question of political community. With whom do we belong? How do we belong? What do we recognize as a viable and valid political community? And we, I don't mean just us in this cosmopolitan elite here, but what works for everybody. And it's a really important question. What makes a strategic community, i.e. one where strategy, the business of generals, yeah? With whom, for whom would you fight? Ukraine at the moment poses that question quite acutely, but it's one for everybody. The dissolution of Yugoslavia, the dissolution of the Soviet Union to a lesser extent, showed how important that question is. Yeah? Do you belong at this level as a political community, or is this your political community? How do you manage? How do you relate? Because these things are not given, as I would say. Key thing is there are ways that it's all part of the processes of checking. But it's seeing that that's all part of a transformation that's going on in this set of simultaneous global changes. And that brings me in the hallows of the LSE to the final comment or question, which is, where is Ernest Gellner in all of this? Because Gellner's theory, Gellner's insight about the rise of nationalism was exactly that it was the social process that helped capture and manage change in the era of industrialization. Scales were changing, education was needed. These were the community affairs. Yeah. What is the next stage of Gellner? Yeah. That's what we need to know. That's what we need to be thinking about. How do we get a Gellner for the globalized world?
Thank you very much. If I may use my position to just insert three other points into the discussion, but I'll do it very quickly. One point is about the stickiness of the changes, and I was sort of struck by your argument and your focus on the state, and that you seem, if I'm not misreading your argument, that there is something about the strength of the state, not in terms of like a big state, right, but in terms of a democratic liberal state that allows it to kind of rebound, even though it adopts some of the restrictive policies in response to the pandemic, that it rebounds, whereas these other sorts of countries that, you know, don't start out with a strong state, they fall behind even further, sort of increasing the gap. So it's kind of quite worrying then that basically then the schism between those you know, we're doing better according to the indices, you know, and the ones that are almost doomed not to do well, kind of, you know, is that kind of a sort of a, almost kind of like a vicious cycle that you're sort of end up with. So basically, so the stickiness of those kind of negative trends. The second that really struck me was about this discussion of globalization. And I just thought whether when you think about globalization, do you think of globalization in liberal terms? And what struck me was that actually we may not be seeing sort of the end of globalization and sort of a return of the state, because anyway, the whole theory about globalization is that you're not really doing away with the state altogether, right? But the state needs to manage the globalization, still plays a role. But I just thought that maybe we are seeing a different kind of globalization, which is like regressive globalization, right? Where you will have the same sort of dynamics of the spread of norms, but the norms will not be liberal norms, okay? So that was, and the third one question is a little bit of a tricky question on purpose, because we start one of our lectures and sort of seminars on one of my courses on reconstruction that has to do with democratization, with a task to the students to come up with a term that would best describe this state of affairs where the country is democratizing, right? Starts from some sort of illiberal position, you know, sort of makes some way towards the democracy and gets stuck, right? And what we do is we collect different terms for this state of affairs, right? Which is one of my sort of hobbies, you know? So we end up with, you know, like concepts like competitive authoritarianism, low quality democracy, etc. And I saw that you kind of most prominently use the concept of hybrid, and another concept that you mentioned was stabilitocracy, which kind of also seemed to me that, I don't know if I could say that, but also you struggled with kind of how do you actually capture, you know, this state of affairs, you know, whether it's through hybridity and whatever, and whether, you know, there were some other ideas on your mind to capture this state of affairs. So how about, Nevin, we give you just 5 minutes for sort of general sort of maybe key responses, like before, because I'm quite keen to invite questions from the audience. And also I would like to invite those of you following on Zoom to put questions in a chat that I will be able to bring into the room as well. So short response, and then we continue the discussion.
Thank you very much. It was worth spending time in writing the book just in order to hear these wise opinions and thoughts. So thank you. Thank you very much. Comparing to the other regions, it's not only my view, but I picked it up from somebody. The Western Balkans, there are three regions in Europe that are being contested between the forces that have a vision or ideology of liberal democracy or more authoritarian kind of the regime. And these regions are Western Balkans, Eastern Europe, what basically Ukraine and what used to be like common neighborhood between the European Union and Russia, Moldova and Belarus, and the third one would be Caucasus. And all three of them, unfortunately, suffer from a violent expression of this contest between the two different kinds. And this kind of it lacks the new world order that would be a mutual understanding is between the dominant powers. And this contest in Western Balkans, I think, might be now more compared to the Caucasus because of the more or less frozen conflicts in the Caucasus and in Western Balkans. I hope it's not frozen, but a kind of solution has been found in the form of seven post-Yugoslav countries plus Albania. Yeah. So it also adds the question of why Croatia is not Western Balkans, and it reminds me of 1990s. BBC used to have a Serbo-Croat section, and then the Foreign Office had a Yugoslav section, and then they called it for a while, I think, Eastern Adriatic. They keep changing these names. What is the best solution? BBC went with Serbian and Croatian, and there was a question, where is Bosnian? So there is always...
Then you end up with BCS. But then where's Montenegro?
This is the problem that is present over there. What I see with Croatia, I think, is that since joining the European Union, some differences existed prior to the 2013, but since joining the European Union, the progress that Croatia made, like Romania since 2007, is significant. It might be still lacking the standards of older members of the European Union, but this enabled both states to develop faster certain institutions and also economies than those who are left outside. And this is what we are going to see very soon on the borders between Bosnia and Croatia, because when Croatia firstly joins Euro and more importantly Schengen, we'll see a kind of reinforcement of the fortress Europe between the two nations that have plenty in common, and also between Croat nation that will be split on both sides of this border. And this is going to cause, I'm sure, tensions or further waves of emigration from Bosnia and Herzegovina for these practical reasons. Aware of the time, I should actually try quickly. Look at the global norms. The term is difficult. Your students are lucky and spending time with you and coming with all these new ideas, but I was trying to invent terms for these indices because they have their own, and then somehow how to kind of measure them against each other. Especially for your problem was with freedoms, individual freedoms, personal freedoms, civil freedoms. What would be the right to the all conquering term? And I'm sure it is always, whatever the decision, it is always the mistake. So we need to keep coming. Gellner, yes, this is something that we should come back in 6 months' time and talk only about this.
Also, in 6 years' time, yeah. 6 years' time, I suspect. Yeah.
Okay, so shall we now invite the questions from the audience? Yeah, perfect.
He's going for one here first.
Oh, okay. All right. So, yeah.
He's in the line of his.
Yeah. So we've had one, two, four questions there and one question over there. So let's collect all of them.
Questions in the chat.
And then see where we are, and then we'll move to the chat. Yes, please. Yes.
Hi.
And I will follow a good old tradition, and I'll ask you to introduce yourself.
Yes. So hi, my name is Sara Milenkovska. I'm a student here studying gender policy and inequalities. And I'm half Macedonian, half Bosnian, so I'm really glad to see people here from the region specifically talking about issues that are really important. I wanted to give some comments, but I'm aware that there are other people having questions. So I'll go straight to my question. I'm looking forward on reading the book, but I wanted to ask you to kind of move beyond the neoliberal notion of globalization And did you found in some of your research certain forms of transnational forms of solidarity from the civil society, in a sense that this might sound anecdotal, but I've seen a lot of efforts where there weren't formal and proper state response to the crisis coming from the COVID-19. And I saw a lot of things happening, like support groups, ways of like how to learn certain things when there isn't a formal way to do that, specifically in Macedonia, I saw that. And this is just to see, like, because I'm aware of like how it influenced bad in general on the already fragile societies, but I'm trying to be a bit delusional idealist and attempt to see if did you found some of your research things that can actually give us positive examples in a way that we can move forward past these effects of this crisis. So thanks.
Thank you. Hello, good evening. My name is Marina Talmović and I come from Montenegro. So yes, plus one for Montenegrin in the VHS discussion. My question is pertaining exactly to commenting further on your findings on Montenegro, because I think we had most interesting development is that exactly in the case of my country, because the 2020 elections have brought out the developments that have been long yearned for in our country. We have turned down the long-lasting rule of DPS, lasting almost 30 years, a very peculiar case of post-communist, let's say, rule in Europe in general, and longest ruling party. So maybe, yeah, commenting on your findings specifically, and seeing how did the new government, who again was changed recently, responded to how you said these developments? Did it bring further the tendencies that were there before? Of course, after the election, we had a bit of emphasis on identity issues, so that maybe took another turn that then would be usually expected in Montenegro's case. But at least, yeah, we can now talk about Montenegro finally exercising the democratic capacity of society, changing the people who rule the country. So yeah, thank you very much.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for the talk and thank you for the discussion. My name is Pedro. I work at Microsoft. So my question is a bit more technology related, if I may. So yeah, with COVID-19, we've seen these platforms like Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn skyrocketing in levels of adoption. And these platforms are can be quite a good a source of spreading the radicalism virus, right? So one opinion of one person can be seen by millions of people. So my question to you is, do you think in a globalized world, should states have a more active role in legislating and regulating these platforms? Or do you think that would go against the control of liberties and freedom of speech? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Sanja Vico, or Vico in English. And I'm a postdoc. I forgot the context that I'm in. But yeah, it's sometimes easier just to kind of adapt. I'm a postdoc here at the LSE in the European Institute, working with Denisa and Vesna on a project about transitional justice and peace building in from Yugoslavia. I have a few questions and comments, but I'll just select one so that everyone has the chance to ask. My first question would be about whether you looked at, and if not, do you think that would be possible and useful to do, to look at public compliance and not compliance with COVID measures, and what does it tell us about the state of democracy? Because what we can see here, and the extent, because I'm not saying that certain countries such as the UK didn't have anti-vax protests and so on, or anti-lockdown protests, they did, but we can still observe some differences. And what I find particularly interesting is that civic disobedience would be treated as a kind of a good sign of a democracy, right? But what we are seeing in the Western Balkans is civic disobedience that has a character of distrust. And distrust is not good for democracy. So for me, this is really interesting. And, you know, I think it does say something, but, you know, how can we measure it and, you know, and so on. I'll just have a quick, you know, comment or observation when you say that a globalization was suspended. I felt it was not actually globalization, but cosmopolitanism, because globalization is lots about interconnectedness and interdependency. And I think that actually COVID pandemic showed how we are all actually very much interconnected. So you had a debate in the UK saying, you know, if the UK doesn't send any kind of vaccines to kind of developing and underdeveloped world, actually we will never get out of the pandemic because of this interconnectedness, you know. But what we could see is, I would say, suspension of the solidarity and cosmopolitan values. So maybe, yeah, just a brief comment. Thank you.
And then we had the question, Sonia, maybe you can more easily pass the mic.
Hello, I am Luca Fustic. I'm a 16-year-old student from Harris Westminster. And after hearing what was an excellent lecture, thank you, about the ethnic nationalism on the rise, the glorification of the 1940s and 1990s, and the mass immigration in particular from Bosnia, as my parents are from Sarajevo, I was just wondering, given that Croatia, having been being a member of the European Union and also making steps towards the Schengen area and joining the euro, I was wondering, looking at Bosnia, what is the process there like? How far are they in this process of European integration, and how, and what do you think the timeline will look like going into the future? Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And what I'll do is I'll just read the question that's arrived. It's not projected there.
The question is, would the formation of open societies not be facilitated if the countries that are leading open societies and have unions like the EU would allow closed societies to join such unions with more ease? As just mentioned, this has worked for Romania and Croatia, but the limitation of access to Ukraine, Serbia, and even Russia reinforces closed societies. If the responsibility then not more with the open societies to be more accepting. And this is the question from Ekaterina Rozanova, lecturer at Goldsmiths College, University of London. Well, you have quite a few questions, but they sort of cluster around the different themes. You know, there is the theme of solidarity, there is a theme of freedom of speech, social media, and there is a theme of the pool of the EU, right? Whether, you know, there is something to look in there, and a very sort of interesting question, of course, raised recently with relation to Ukraine and its application to EU, whether sort of membership can and should be, or should be expedited. So.
Thank you. Let me start with the EU issue, the last one. One thing is that I think a couple of days ago, French President Macron suggested a new form of the Union European Political Community, something like this. It reflects, I think, consistency of French foreign policy. Mitterrand in 1989, revolutionary 1989, celebrated for liberal values and so on, he suggested the creation of the European Confederation. It was debated for a year or so, and then abandoned. It was very much inclusive of what is now post-Soviet space. So it was pretty much open to all Europeans. And in some way, it could be interpreted as anti-American, because Europe should not depend so much on Americans. But obviously, there are different choices, didn't work. We can go back to De Gaulle and his visions of Europe and why Britain should stay out. They have the vision. A couple of years ago, there was a Macedonian case in Albania, the non-paper, again, resistance to the expansion of Europe, European Union. I think there is one way of interpreting would be selfishness of all the democracies. I would admit that they have some justification for this. When you see the performance of the governments in these countries that want. The main argument in Bosnia when Ukraine asked for express process, the main argument in Bosnia, could it somehow jump in with Ukrainians? Because there is no way our power holders would ever lead us towards European integration. So by not fulfilling the conditions, this is really the problem. When you consider the developments that were taking place during the pandemic that somehow accentuated some the relations within the society from before, I think that unfortunately, they have a strong argument to keep them outside and kind of second prize to provide them, to offer them, and that would be this kind of political union. It is also to mark the territory in a way like some pets are doing it to send a message to Moscow, this is ours. They are not fully our close relatives, but it is ours. So this is how I see it. This is basically also related to Bosnia and Herzegovina. One interesting thing that is ongoing on micro level, those old enough to remember, or those who studied the post-Yugoslav wars and the attack on Dubrovnik, the main forces came from Trebinje. It's 28 kilometers between the two different countries now. There was a real strongly expressed hatred, one could say, between the two communities or misunderstanding, whatever. Anyway, for quite some time, people from Trebinje didn't travel to Dubrovnik at all for whatever reason. Now, it's impossible to find a labor, a workforce for tourist industry, for catering, waiters in Trebinje, because they all work in Dubrovnik. This is another of the elements of the possibilities for the more integrative forces that economy might actually provide some positive measures. And just jumping to Montenegro issue, this is the only case of the elections. There are quite few firsts in Western Balkans. The first use of force against peaceful demonstrators was in Tirana by Prime Minister. He sent people demonstrating not against COVID measures, but against the demolition of one old theater to preserve architecture. Element of this. The first elections under the pandemic conditions in Serbia that returned almost one party parliament. Jasna mentioned, I mentioned it in the book, using a raspberry farmer to import medical equipment in Bosnia or furniture company. Then in Montenegro, there was a naming and shaming people who actually have COVID. In Kosovo was the case that the first two persons that brought COVID were named by local authorities. And then you can imagine the reaction. So they have their firsts that were taking place. But the only case when the old powers, the people, the government in power lost elections was Montenegro. And that came as a surprise after 30 years. This is the difference that I see it, you might disagree. Montenegrin nationalism, is the only inclusive form of nationalism in post-Yugoslav countries. Others are exclusive. They are inclusive because they rely on support of minorities, political parties representing minorities in Montenegro. I am strongly against the nature of the government by Montenegro,
Macedonia.
The nature of government and the way how they govern for 30 years, I mean, it must be wrong since they are in power for 30 years, but they exercise inclusive nationalism. Yes, thank you. Macedonia, since the current government, the previous one was exclusive and so on. And the general values, this is when I started coughing originally, so I didn't say it, the ways how in Montenegro, the example of misogynist policies and public opinions, basically the general society, and this is the problem when it comes to the discrimination, that one of the leading journalists was described, just to find, as a biological entity with human shape and female attributes. So this is when we are talking about discrimination that is present in the society, talking about personal freedoms and generally what kind of society we are describing. Another kind of test for the society could come from Macedonia. This is what reminded me. So this liberal prime minister, we are talking now about discrimination of people of sexual minorities. So this liberal prime minister said that a government is not going to fall because of one faggot. Forgive me, LGBT community. He said, forgive me, but still it didn't help much. So these are the kind of ruling caste in the region. Would they be acceptable in the European Union? Well, we can find some examples, I mean, in Westminster, but yes, but they are out of the EU now, but in some other countries it could be found. Sorry, Denisa, could you just remind me what I failed to reference? So, my
technology. Yes, social media.
Yes, thank you. When Trump was banned from Twitter, I think that was a scandalous measure. Luckily my son is not around. He confronts me on this one. But they used him. It was good for business. And only when he was entering the last month of his mandate, they banned him for certain values that he disrespected and so on. The private company took this decision. It wasn't court's decision. So this is the problem, that private companies have enormous power now. I strongly disagree with Trump with his policies. I don't know if I could find anything that I would agree with him. But it wasn't court's decision. This is the problem for the state. State is undermined. And it was a decision by the shareholders or whomever, executives who are responsible to the shareholders. And this is the problem for the future. They have enormous powers. Traditional media is losing its grounds, and we have this new media taking over, being more influential and being basically a platform for spreading alternative or dangerous ideologies. So I would argue that state has to be involved in regulating this, like it is involved in television, electronic media, or press.
Well, thank you so much, Nevin. So if I may end with a comment on indicators. Yeah, if there is one indicator of a good book, it's a good discussion. I think we could have continued on and on, but I thoroughly enjoyed this. I think shows you tickled our intellects, gave us lots of food for thought. And I think it's been quite impressive the range of issues that you mentioned to bring in and to comment on while focusing on democracy. I would also like to thank our audience for fantastic questions. It's really amazing to be here. So to thank the LSE sort of crowd, we always count on you, and you haven't disappointed. But we particularly welcome those of you who've come from outside LSE, maybe future students as well. So thank you for fantastic questions, and also thank you all for who are following through Zoom, and thank you, Nevin, but also Jasna and James. These were you gave us sort of very insightful and thoughtful comments about the book, but also beyond, to think about issues that we could discuss further. Gellner, of course. Please follow LSE events in the future. Come again. And also big thanks to Samson, who was a key person behind organizing this. Well, have a nice evening. Come again. Should I ask about the price of your book?
Don't ask about the price. Wait for this. I signed that it could be free electronic version, but it is not yet. But it's £108, so I will buy it.
Another good bit of marketing.
Yes. Well, we have the gist of it. Okay. Thank you.